Welcome to Madlit Musings, the podcast where we dive into the minds of authors, exploring the profound realms of faith, social issues, and the delightful world of entertainment. I'm your host, Jamie Jill Wright, and on this literary journey, you never quite know what you're going to get. Hey there, Madlit enthusiasts. Our podcast is sponsored by the esteemed Baker Publishing Group. Whether you're into heartwarming romance, gripping suspense, or deep dives into matters of faith and society, Baker Publishing Group has it all. With Revell and Bethany House Publishers under their umbrella, they bring you a diverse array of books that will captivate your mind and stir your soul. Check out all of their line at www.bakerbookhouse.com. Hi, everyone. It is Jamie Jill Wright with Madlit Musings. And today I have with me Angela Bell from Bethany House Publishers. Hey, Angela.
Hey, Jamie.
I'm not sure I could have gotten more dramatic with that opening.
The suspense you were building.
Well, actually, I'll be honest. I was going to say with debut author. And then I was like, my brain goes, no, she's published before. This is just her first full length. So I can't really say debut author. And all of that went through my head in about split second. And that's why there was a dramatic pause.
Well, it's been so long since my novellas came out. I kind of feel like a newbie. Like I very much feel like this is my first go around because it's all so new and so different.
It's very different when you release a full length in comparison to a novella. Because you and I both had very similar starts where we both did three novellas with Barber Publishing and then moved to Bethany House. So it's an experience. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. A lot more pressure when it's just your name on the book. Like with the novellas, I'm like, there's big authors in here. Like nobody cares about me. Like they're here for the other authors. So pressure's off in that respect.
Right. Yeah. When you're the rookie name on a novella collection, your email inbox stays pretty empty on release. Yeah. They're more interested in the name that was at the beginning of the list.
And the reviews pop up and you're not even mentioned. They're just like, this author's book is amazing. I love all her books. The novella is just as good. And I'm like, I was there too. But nobody cares.
Right. If we were a cartoon figure, we'd literally be hanging on to the shirt tails of the big name author of our novella collection. So
totally.
But that's okay because they're a great place to start. However, you are no longer sharing a book cover with anybody. You are sharing the name Angela Bell with yourself on the latest release called A Lady's Guide to Marvels and Misadventure. So, did you title that or did the titling committee?
I did not. I cannot take credit for that. That was the amazing titling committee. My original title was a lot less cool. They asked for suggestions and I was like, okay, so I gave them like this huge long list and then they wound up with something completely and totally different, but they totally nailed it on the head. Like it completely sums up the story. Mm-hmm. So I'm very pleased with the title.
Yeah. I don't know if readers know this and I don't know if this is the same with every publisher, but with Baker Publishing Group and Bethany House, they actually have titling committees. So as authors, we submit a working title perhaps, and then other words and things that could potentially be worked into a title. But there's actually a boardroom that sits down and they all meet and throw and banter around titles until they settle on something. So I don't think readers realize that. I think a lot of times they think we title our books.
Yeah, I don't think I realized that until I started actually getting involved in the industry. It's like, oh, you don't get to pick your title, you don't get to pick your cover and tell them exactly what you want. Like
so your cover is really cool. Your cover is not the typical I guess I would say historical romance cover where you've got a pretty woman or a profile or something and it's glossy. Yours is definitely much more curious. Like I'm like a curiosity cabinet of little things. There's a globe and a book and wheels and gears and I like it. What do you think? Were you excited when you saw it?
I adore this cover so much. I cannot express with words how much I adore this cover. Again, they completely nailed it on the head. I gave them a bunch of suggestions, but I was like, but we have to be careful because this story is not the typical historical romance. I mean, it's a historical romance story, but with a twist, and I wanted to make sure we set that expectation like right from the get-go so readers didn't feel disillusioned when
Right.
they're getting a traditional historical romance and they pick up my silly book. So I was like, I gave them a lot of ideas, but I really didn't know what they were going to do. And then they came back with this fantastic, I mean, it was perfect. Like,
It's great.
it captures, and every single element on the cover has some sort of significance to the story
Yes.
from, I mean, literally everything. I was so impressed.
Yes.
Like,
Yes.
there's not an element that was not thought through or tied into the book. I mean, even the little starbursts, like everything.
Yep. And I'm
Yeah.
nodding because
This is my
I think
favorite.
halfway through it. So
Right.
yes. I was trying to finish it before we did the podcast, but in between deadlines and my own day job and things like that, I haven't gotten the chance to get through it all, but it's super fun. I think if I were going to explain it or describe it to a reader, and I don't know if you'll agree with me on this, but I would describe it as a whimsical historical romance with steampunk elements.
That
That's how
works.
I describe it. Because if you say it's steampunk, well, then people are like, oh, I don't want to read that. Or it's fantasy or it's speculative. And it's not futuristic at all. But you do have characters in there that are working with gears and robotics and mechanisms. And do tell us about the story. Let's go there. What's the book about?
So first of all, I love your description. It's right on the head. So this story is set in the Victorian era in 1860, and my heroine Clara is a merchant's daughter, and she's fiercely loyal to her family, and she's spending her days trying to protect them from her ex-fiancé, who is spreading rumors that her family suffers from hereditary insanity because he's trying to blackmail her into taking him back and marrying him so he can get a hold of her fortune. And he's using her family's eccentricities as grounds for these claims of hereditary insanity. And her family is very much unbothered. They do not care what society thinks of them. They're just living their best lives, and they have none of Clara's worries, which is increased when her grandfather, who's a clockmaker, takes on an apprentice with a mechanical leg, and she doesn't trust him immediately because her ex-fiance has been going to the extreme of sending spies into the house looking for evidence to solidify his claims. So she immediately thinks that my poor hero, Theodore, is a spy sent by her ex-fiance. So we immediately have some tension and conflict there. And then this all accelerates when her grandfather decides that they need to stop having pretend adventures. She needs to embrace her dreams of travel and go on a real adventure. And when she won't come with him, he's like, okay, then I'm going to entice you to follow me across Europe by setting off in my secret clockwork flying owl machine. And he invites her to join him on this merry scavenger hunt. So then
Yes.
she come along to fetch him because she doesn't want scandal and the horrors of people find out that this man accused of insanity is flying around Europe in a clockwork owl machine. So she sets off, and the apprentice comes, and her mom comes, and hilarity ensues.
I will say, her family is extremely eccentric.
Oh,
There is no
yes.
question. I mean, is it the mink stole? Is it a mink? I can't remember.
Ermine, little Fred,
Yes, yes. And her
the
mother was
very much alive stole
right,
that
the very much alive stole, which I think
her.
I would take Fred any day and wear him around my neck. I would much prefer Fred because he's alive. It's much more cozy. I never understood the concept of draping dead animals around your neck and it being stylish.
I don't either. I mean, I can see the beauty of fur, but when there's like an actual pelt with a face
Yeah,
and
it's a little
like
weird.
little black beady eyes,
Yeah.
I don't understand. I don't understand that at all.
No, I get fur from a practical standpoint. Like if I'm an outdoorsman or something like that, from warmth, those types of things, I wouldn't be anti-pelts, but wearing them around my neck with a, flapper dress and 1920s pearls is always a little of a weird thought to me. But anyway, but we're at 1860, so I got the era wrong. But okay, so I have to admit, while I've been reading this, her grandfather, who is, by the way, got the best last name, Drosselmeyer.
Yeah.
Like, Drosselmeyer? Where did we come up with that name?
That is taken from the Nutcracker. This story was heavily inspired by.
Heard it.
Yeah, the story is inspired by Around the World in 80 Days meets the Nutcracker. So Drosselmeyer's name comes from there, Clara's name comes from there, and then
Okay.
there's some more subtle inspiration for Theodore. Theodore's name is the middle initial of the original author of the Nutcracker story,
Okay.
E.T.A. Hoffman. The T in his name is Theodore.
Okay.
Yeah, that's where the Drosselmeyer comes from.
Lots of fun symbolism. I felt like I'd heard that name before, but I couldn't figure it out. And then I was kind of laughing because it was a little bit quirky, which fits the story. And then I will admit that every time I read the Grand's character, I'm thinking about the cartoon version of Beauty and the Beast's father. Did I nail it?
Okay, so that's my favorite Disney movie. So yeah, that was not a direct inspiration, but there are so many Easter eggs in this book to different books and movies that I love.
That's
And Beauty and the Beast is definitely one of them, especially
okay.
Belle's father, the
Yes.
crazy inventor. So
Yes.
yeah, you
Yeah.
got it. Awesome.
I got one anyway. That's super fun. Well, and it's just kind of like, I think the thing that made me really think of it was when he's working in his shop and then he like jerks up from the counter or whatever, and there's flying mechanical owls around his head, and it just reminded me of something straight out of a Disney movie, and it was just really funny. So I don't know, that's what inspired me. I'm like, oh, it's Belle's father.
Crazy old Maurice at it again.
Crazy old Maurice. So all right, so this is interesting. So you, okay, it's very whimsical, there's lots of humor, there's lots of animals.
Yes.
The animal part, let's go there. Are you like a major animal lover, and this is something we can expect in future books, or is this just something that you thought fit the book?
It's both and. I adore animals. I've grown up with pets since I was little, and I grew up with my mom was really big into nature studies, and she homeschooled us,
Okay.
so we were always, if we went on a walk and we saw a caterpillar, it turned into a science lesson. If we were at the zoo and we saw a lion, it turned into a science lesson. So my mom is actually a big inspiration for the Mrs. Stanton character in general, including her love of animals. So yeah, that was a big part of where the inspiration came from, but I would not be surprised if I have animals popping up in future books just because I love them so much. And they're a
Yeah.
good source of humor.
They really are. They really are. Humor and comfort and all that. All that is 100% true. And a lot of readers really like stories with animals in it too. And I went to a writers conference on a side note. I don't know if you were there or if you've ever heard this, but there's a general rule with books. And it's really important for me because I tend to kill things in my books, which yours doesn't seem to be going along that vein. So if someone's looking for suspense and thriller, probably not going to find it in this one so much. So suspense, but not necessarily death and murder.
Okay. There's some suspense in the second half, but
Yeah.
no dead bodies for you.
No
I'm
dead
sorry.
bodies, no ghosts. I guess that's where I was going with it. But anyway, the general rule is, you can kill whoever you want to kill, but you don't kill a dog.
No,
Ever.
absolutely
Do not kill
not.
an animal. No, you don't. You don't. You will
No.
literally get blasted by readers.
I've thrown books across the room, like physically. Because an author killed an animal, and I was like, you literally could have killed anybody else in this scene, and I'd have been fine.
You could
Not
have killed the
the
main character. You could have killed her, just not the dog. Oh, it's funny. I will admit, when I was in that writers conference and they said that, I think I busted out laughing like really a little bit too loudly. And it's not because I'm insensitive and don't love dogs. It was just not what I expected to hear. Like, You can slaughter the entire cast, but don't slaughter the dog. Okay, then I won't. So now
Well, that
you
still leaves us
die
like
in your
with
box.
a lot of ground. I mean, you can literally kill
Yeah,
anybody else.
I know, right? So, okay, so let's talk about your story some more because I always get off on rabbit trails, and that's just an inevitability. So, welcome to the podcast. But as we talk about your book, and you were mentioning the last half does have some suspense. And when we think suspense, sometimes we're thinking like high octane guns, shoot 'em up, mystery murder, that type of thing. So, explain the stylistic approach to suspense that you have in your book.
So the suspense element in my book comes from the heroine's fiance, ex-fiance. When he finds out that she set off after her grandfather, he follows her. So I've got a stalker element, and that kind of starts to intensify the further you get into the book as the hero realizes they're being followed. And he's keeping an eye over his shoulder, and he thinks that it's a journalist because once this flying machine takes off, it doesn't go unnoticed. So there
Well, a
are all of,
giant flying owl
I
that's
mean,
mechanical would be a little bit hard to miss.
yeah, it's kind of a thing. So they wind up with journalists all over Europe trying to track down this invention and try to figure out, who invented it, what's its purpose, what's going on. And then this kind of ties into that around the world in 80 days element with the wagers. So all of a sudden there's all of these bets across the country of who the pilot is and where the machine is going. And this catches the attention of Prince Albert, who was very into science and technology, and he wants to meet the inventor. So he offers a prize purse and says, if the inventor will come here, you'll be given this prize purse. So that's all the incentive Clara's greedy ex-fiance needs to go get this machine for himself. So
Right.
we've got a very determined, very desperate stalker on their heels, which becomes more apparent the later into the book you get.
That's cool. So London, England, 1860. Paint a picture of the history because that, if you were to go across the sea, that's just pre-Civil War, in the United States. I mean, everything obviously in the US was going a little bit wonky at that point in time. What was England like? Like, what was the history and things going on in the culture around that?
Well, this is right in the middle of the Industrial Revolution. So we've got a boom of technology. And then there was the actual railway boom going on where, the steam engine has gotten to a point where it's safe enough for commercial travel, not just freight, but passengers. And so there's this boom during that period of railway expanding, and people traveling more for leisure. So we've got that going on, which is a big deal for my heroine because, it's any new technology is very scary. So she's got this fear of trains. I play up an actual historical event that happened earlier that year called the Tottenham Railway Crash, where a rail crash, it derailed and the carriages turned over. And it burst into flames, and people weren't able to get out because I did not realize, one, they were called train carriages and not train cars at the time, which makes sense hindsight because there were no
Oh,
cars.
yeah, that's a good point. I never thought of that.
So they were train carriages, and because of the way they were designed at the time, passengers were locked inside them by these guards. And so it was for their safety. But then when one caught on fire, they could not get out.
Oh no.
So that was an actual disaster that happened. And I used that to play up Clara's fear of trains. So then when she starts going on this journey with her grandfather, she's like, what do you mean I have to get on a train? Those things are death traps. You get
Right.
locked inside. They're going at the ungodly speed of 40 miles per hour. This is crazy. So that was a fun kind of cultural thing to dig into and learn about. And kind of mirrors some of the fears we have about technology today. It's like there's nothing new under the sun. Any new technology is immediately viewed upon with skepticism and fear.
Oh yeah. Which is understandable because it's new. I mean, it's new ground and you don't know. And then you look at like that train derailment and It's the things you don't know that will cause the drama and the horror around it. Like, they just let the doors open. You
Yeah.
know, some of that wouldn't have happened, but because they didn't know,
Yeah, there
thus.
was also an interesting thing that I learned where there was this fear of railway madness because you were going so fast. There was a fear that the speed and the jostling around would literally like unhook your brain inside your head and bash it
Oh.
around. And they were afraid people were going to go insane. So
Oh.
I found actual like newspaper reports and medical journals talking about how people needed to be careful. Don't look outside the windows because the scenery going by could overwhelm you sensory and cause insanity. You know, you need to hold on, hold your head in place. You don't want your brain to get
Oh.
shaken too much. So then that's another thing that Clara has to deal with because, you know, her family's already accused of insanity.
Right,
And
yeah,
now
you don't want
this
to
possibility
exacerbate
of,
that.
he was like, what if they actually become insane by being on this train?
And 150 years later, they'll watch Top Gun and realize that G-forces are way worse than a train. Wow. Oh, that's funny. I've never heard that one. Okay, so for all the podcast listeners out there, if you go on a train, do not look out the window for fear of losing your mind, because your brain comes unhinged, apparently. Wow. There's a new one. I've never heard that before. I kind of want to do things with that in my story
I
mind,
thought
but
you might like that.
well, it is, you know, but of course my brain starts twisting it sadistically, so we won't. Okay. All right. And so, you know, I understand it because I do a lot of reading and I do a lot of research, but help the reader understand why it would have been such a bad thing for her ex-fiance to make a case about insanity in the family. Because, you know, today we almost, I don't want to say we celebrate it, but we honor people who struggle with mental health issues, and we try to be very sensitive to that and very respectful of people with mental disabilities and struggles and conditions. And so back in those days, what's the difference? Like, why didn't they view it the same way? And what was the stigma around it?
So yeah, the social view of any type of mental illness or even a physical disability was very different during the Victorian era. It was viewed as something to be ashamed of. It was viewed as a physical weakness. So the villain, her ex-fiance uses that as a reason why they broke up because, you know, he didn't want his bloodline contaminated
Oof.
with her family's hereditary insanity. It was also, there was this big connection in the Victorian era between any type of mental illness and morality. You know, if someone was mentally ill, then it was perceived that they were also morally askew.
Okay.
There was that type of connotation, which is very tragic. But the main thing that is different is the mindset of mental illness is something that needs to be hidden away. It needs to be locked away. Anyone that's read Jane Eyre is familiar with that concept. And so my heroine's dealing with a lot of fear because if her fiance can validate these claims, it wouldn't be a matter of someone coming to her and saying, okay, we need to get your family help. It would be a matter of government officials coming to her home, forcibly taking her family members away and locking them up against her will. And the asylums back then were not actually a place of treatment and healing and wholeness. It was just keep them contained and keep them unseen. And so there are a lot of atrocities that occur in these government-run mental asylums at the time. Anyone who's familiar with Nellie Bly and her 10 Days in a Madhouse expose, where she pretended to be mentally unstable, got herself locked into an asylum, and then reported on the things that she saw, both the supposed treatment that the patients were undergoing and the fact that there were people in there that were not mentally insane at all. So there was just a lot of corruption. There was a lot of prejudice. and lack of empathy for anyone who was different, who thought differently, who processed emotions differently, who processed grief differently. And so it's a big deal for my heroine to be dealing with these rumors. It's not just a matter of, oh, her family could be ruined and not invited over for tea. It's she could literally lose people she loves to a government institution and they could die in there.
Right.
And she knows this from personal experience because her uncle was a soldier in the army and he suffered a grievous injury that affected him not just physically, but also mentally. And her family did not know this, but he just went missing on the battlefield. And then all of a sudden, they haven't heard from him. He's missing. They send a friend of theirs to go looking for him and find out that the government had locked him and some other soldiers away in an institution without telling them. And because of the conditions there, he died. So my heroine's got a very tangible example of what happens in those institutions, which amplifies her fear, when her fiance is bringing these accusations against the family.
And I think that's important for readers to understand too, if they don't already, because it makes a very whimsical story have an element of seriousness underlying. That you start realizing how much threat Claire is really struggling against, and how much probably personal angst and anxiety that's bringing out in herself to try to mask and protect her family, who views their own totally non-mental illness issues, but eccentricities as potential pitfalls for misunderstanding. So, that's definitely an interesting thread in your book. And it's interesting too when you study the trajectory of the wards and the asylums that both in the United States and in England, but where they went, and then eventually they get into the eugenics movement, where it was the testings and trying to fix the brain and eliminate, and which interestingly enough, as you study the family tree of the struggle with mental illness leads into, even World War II, where Hitler was very big in eugenics and wanting to maintain that perfect gene, that perfect line of genealogy. So anyway, it's crazy. It's a deep subject in a very whimsical book.
Yeah, I was actually worried it would be a little too heavy at points, so I worked very hard to kind of balance the heavy themes and handle them with the seriousness that they warrant, and balance that with the humor and the romance and the other elements to keep it from being too heavy. I personally, as a reader, have a much easier time reading about heavy subjects when they're balanced with humor and other things, so.
And I think that's important too. I think the other thing that's really important for readers who are hearing this interview and maybe haven't read the book, to understand that you do treat the concepts of mental illness with extreme respect. There's the whimsical side, but there's a lot of respect for individuals who may or may not struggle with that. And then also, even the concept of showing the value and eccentricities and the value in people who aren't necessarily what you would say are your average person, people with really unique creative personalities and, not worried about what the other people think. They just want to live their life. I love her mother. Her mother's very much that way.
Oh, she's Mrs. Stanton's my favorite character. I adore her. She was the one that actually changed the trajectory of the story because I was going for a more traditional historical romance. It was going to be very serious, and I was like, this is going to be, a serious historical romance like Christy Cameron or, Joanne Bischoff. Like, this is going to be serious. And then I knew I was going to be dealing with these serious issues and I wanted to give them the respect that they deserve. But then the characters kept goofing off, especially Mrs. Stanton, and they just would not let up. And I was like, y'all need to get in line. And finally, Mrs. Stanton was just kind of off to the side of my imagination going, but why? Why can't it be a comedy? If that, because I hit a roadblock, it's like the story would not move. And it was like, okay. Let's just see what happens when I let them do what they want to do and try, instead of trying to force them into this box And that was the point when the story completely shifted. The humor took off. The scavenger hunt idea came about. And I kind of found my author voice while writing this book.
Yeah. And that happens too. It's interesting when I did that with The House on Foster Hill. I was trying to achieve just very kind of like your typical box of what you thought it was going to fit into in the industry. And then all of a sudden you're like, these characters are not cooperating. This is getting much, and in my situation, it was like getting darker, it's getting creepier, there's more like creepy, weird, ghostly things happening, and there is no way a Christian publisher is going to want something with that in it, and therefore they did. So I love it when publishers take a chance on different styles. And I guess I would say for the readers who are wondering, is this the book I should try? Yes, you should try it. And two, it's fun because it's not your run-of-the-mill novel that you pull off the shelf. It's definitely got its own voice, and it's a very unique spot within the bookshelf of Christian fiction out there. So kudos to you. I like that. Okay, so if readers want to find out more about your book, which is once again titled A Lady's Guide to Marvels and Misadventure by Angela Bell, how do they find out more about you and your book? And I know you've got more books coming in the future, so where do we follow you?
The best place for readers to connect with me would be on my website, authorangelabell.com. From there, they will find links to my socials and to a podcast that I'm a guest book reviewer on, so they can connect with me there.
Awesome. Sounds good. Well, thank you so much for being part of the podcast today. And now we're going to have to sign off so I can go finish the book.
Okay, thank you so much for having me on, Jamie. It's been a delight.
Thank you for joining Mad Lit Musings, where every conversation is a journey and every book is a new adventure. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast player or check us out on YouTube. And let's explore the fascinating intersection of faith, society, and storytelling together.